feel good, more confident, more likely to contribute and feel empowered. Perhaps it's for someone who likes the status of having someone wait on him. Once a week, he gets to sit in a throne with a well-dressed, respectful craft person putting effort into his appearance. Perhaps it's a signifier that he wouldn't bother with this except that it's what people like him are supposed to do. And not any shoeshine. This shoeshine, in this public spot, from this respected craft person. Any of these edges and stories and transformations are available to the craft person as soon as he decides to make a difference. Knowing that this is the story your customer tells himself is insufficient, you still have to act on it, open the door to the possibility, and organize the entire experience around that story. This is the work that helps people understand that you are special, and this is the work that makes things better. When you know what you stand for, you don't need to compete. Bernadette Jiwa has written half a dozen extraordinary books that humanize the too often industrialized craft of marketing. In Story Driven, she makes it clear that if we merely try to fill a hole in the market, we're doomed to a cycle of rearview mirror behavior. We're nothing but a commodity in the making, always wary of our competition. We have no choice but to be driven by scarcity, focused on maintaining or perhaps slightly increasing our market share. The alternative is to find and build and earn your story, the arc of the change you seek to produce. This is a generative posture, one based on possibility, not scarcity. Now that you've chosen your audience, where do you want to take them? Bernadette shares 10 things that good stories do. If the story you're telling yourself and others doesn't do these things for you, you might need to dig deeper and find a better story, one that's more true and more effective. Good stories, 1, connect us to our purpose and vision for our career or business. 2, allow us to celebrate our strengths by remembering how we got from there to here. 3, deepen our understanding of our unique value and what differentiates us in the marketplace. 4, reinforce our core values. 5, help us to act in alignment and make value-based decisions. 6, encourage us to respond to customers instead of react to the marketplace. 7, attract customers who want to support businesses that reflect or represent their values. 8, build brand loyalty and give customers a story to tell. 9, attract the kind of like-minded employees we want. 10, help us to stay motivated and continue to do work we're proud of. But your story is a hook, and you're on it. Once you claim a story, once you commit to wanting to help people change, to take them on a journey from here to there, then you're on the hook. On the hook to deliver. On the hook for what happens next. Is it any wonder we'd prefer to make average stuff for average people? If all you do is offer an alternative, that's a low-risk path. Take it or leave it. On the other hand, great marketing is the generous and audacious work of saying, I see a better alternative. Come with me. Case study. Stack Overflow is better. If you're a programmer, you've visited Stack Overflow. It's a profitable company with more than 250 employees dealing with millions of visits a week. If you have a question, it's probably already been answered on one of their forums. Stack Overflow saves programmers time and effort, and it's also a passion project for thousands of the volunteers who contribute content. How did its founder, Joel Spolsky, make better happen? In the early years of the 2000s, there was a programming forum called Experts Exchange. Their model was simple and obvious. They hosted answers to common programming questions, and you had to pay to read them. A subscription cost $300 per year. In order to build the business, they came at it from a place of scarcity. The questions were free to read, but the answers cost money. To get traffic, they tricked the primitive Google robots that searched the web by showing them the answers, which got them good search engine traffic. But when people showed up, they scrambled the information, hiding the answers until people subscribed. Experts Exchange created profit via frustration. Joel worked with his co-founder, programmer Jeff Atwood, to come up with a different approach. Make the questions visible, make the answers visible, and pay for the whole thing with job advertising. After all, what better place to find great programmers than a website where great programmers come to ask questions and give answers? Along the way, Joel discovered that creating a better product meant treating different people differently, telling stories to each constituency that matched its worldview and needs. For programmers in a hurry, he made it easy to find a question and the best answer for it. The answers are ranked by quality, so programmers don't waste time. He realized that for every person who answered a question, 1,000 people wanted an answer. Instead of trying to frustrate questioners, he got out of their way and gave them what they needed. But answerers were different. For them, he built a community, a ranking system, a series of levels that would enable them to build a reputation and be rewarded with power over the community. And job board posters were different as well. They wanted a fast, efficient, self-service method to find the best people. No hard sell, no distractions. Joel didn't want to put his personal stamp on a personal site. He set out to be of service, to make things more efficient, to tell people a story that they wanted and needed to hear. He built something better, and he let the core audience not only spread the word, but do the thing that an outsider might have thought of as work. Better is up to the users, not up to you. Google is better. It was better than Bing and better than Yahoo. Better in what way? The search results weren't obviously better. The search itself wasn't dramatically faster. What was better was that the search box didn't make you feel stupid. Yahoo had 183 links on their homepage. Google had 2. It projected confidence and clarity. You couldn't break it. So it was better for some people. Now, DuckDuckGo is better because it isn't part of a big company, because it doesn't track you, because it's different. So it's better for some people. And we serve coffee. Until a fire temporarily shut them down, actually, it was the sprinklers, not the coffee maker, that did the damage. Trident Booksellers and Cafe in Boston was one of the most vibrant and successful bookstores in the country. No matter how cheap and big Amazon got, Trident managed to do pretty well because they do something Amazon can't. They serve coffee. If you run a retail store that competes with anyone online, and we serve coffee is not a bad tagline. That's because coffee is better together. Coffee creates a third place, a spot to meet, to connect, to dream. And so Trident is actually a coffee shop that sells books. The books we just bought are a souvenir of the personal connections we made today. The authentic, vulnerable hero. You know this archetype, the woman who shows up with her full self, her inner truth, ready to withstand the slings and arrows of a world that doesn't get her, until it does, and then they celebrate. This is a myth. It's a dangerous myth. There are a few exceptions that prove the rule, but in general, what's true is that we need people willing to be of service. Service to the change they seek to make. Willing to tell a story that resonates with a group that they care enough to serve. There could be an overlap. It's possible that it's the way you feel right this minute, but it might not be. The version of you on offer might run many layers deep, but it can't possibly be all of you all the time. A professional plays a role, doing the best possible work, regardless of the day or the patient or the client. When James Brown fell on his knees on stage, exhausted, needing to be resuscitated by his attendants, it was brilliant stagecraft, not an authentic performance. After all, it happened every night. When a therapist changes lives all day long by listening patiently, he actually might be patient, but it's more likely he's simply doing his job. When the barista at Starbucks smiles at you and wishes you a great day, he's presenting, not revealing. That's fine, because revealing isn't what better looks like. Revealing is reserved for your family and your closest friends, not the marketplace. Protect yourself. You'll be needed tomorrow. Service. Marketing acts, interesting choice of word, acts, are the generous actions of people who care. James Brown and the therapist understand that authenticity in the marketplace is a myth, that what people want is to be understood and to be served, not merely to witness whatever you feel like doing in a given moment. And when we do the best version of our best work, our responsibility isn't to make it for ourselves. It's to bring it to the person we seek to serve. We reserve our best version of the work for them, not for us. Just as a 3-star chef doesn't cook herself a 12-course meal for dinner, you are not expected, or welcome, to bring us every one of your insecurities, innermost fears, and urgent demands. You're here to serve. Authenticity versus emotional labor. Emotional labor is the work of doing what we don't feel like doing. It's about showing up with a smile when we're wincing inside, or resisting the urge to chew someone out because you know that engaging with him will make a bigger difference. It takes a small amount of energy and guts to be authentic. You need to feel confident enough to let your true feelings be exposed, knowing that if you're rejected, it's personal. But there's a lot of hiding involved as well. Hiding from the important work of making change happen. If all you do is follow your make-believe muse, you may discover that the muse is a chicken and it's steering you away from the important work. And if the authentic you is a selfish jerk, please leave him at home. If you need to be authentic to do your best work, you're not a professional. You're a fortunate amateur. Fortunate because you have a gig where being the person you feel like being in the moment actually helps you move forward. For the rest of us, there's the opportunity to be a professional, to exert emotional labor in search of empathy. The empathy to imagine what someone else would want, what they might believe, what story would resonate with them. We don't do this work because we feel like it in the moment. We do this work this draining emotional labor because we're professionals and because we want to make change happen. Emotional labor is the work we do to provide service. Who's talking? When you get an email from a faceless corporation speaking in the second person, someone is hiding. It's slick, but it's not real. We don't feel a connection, merely the shadow of a bureaucrat. On the other hand, when a human being extends emotional labor to take responsibility, here, I made this, then the door is open to connection and growth. The most effective organizations don't always have a famous leader or a signature on every email, but they act like they do. Here, I made this. The goal isn't to personalize the work. It's to make it personal. Chapter 7. The Canvas of Dreams and Desires. Everything you've been taught in school and at work about doing a good job has been about meeting spec, delivering on the assignment, getting the A, doing the specific thing for the specific industrial purpose. What do you do is about a task, a measurable, viable thing. Consider this job description from the U.S. government. Sewing machine operator, grade 6. Sets up and runs a variety of domestic and industrial type power-operated sewing machines and related special purpose machines such as buttonhole, basting, and feed-off the arm machines. Makes independent judgments and decisions within the framework of oral or written instructions and accepted methods, techniques, and procedures. Continually handles objects weighing up to 5 kilograms, 10 pounds, and occasionally objects weighing up to 9 kilograms, 20 pounds. Works inside in areas that usually have adequate light, heat, and fresh air. Is exposed to the possibility of cuts and bruises. While this is the description of a job, it's not the description of a dream or a desire. While it's specific, it could easily be changed without altering what it delivers. This is how money works as well. $20 bills are meaningless. It's what you buy with them that we work for. The same is true of your product or service. You may say you're offering a widget, but you don't believe it. When you're marketing change, you're offering a new emotional state, a step closer to the dreams and desires of your customers, not a widget. We sell feelings, status, and connection, not tasks or stuff. What do people want? If you ask them, you probably won't find what you're looking for. You certainly won't find a breakthrough. It's our job to watch people, figure out what they dream of, and then create a transaction that can deliver that feeling. The crowd didn't invent the Model T, the smartphone, or rap. The crowd didn't invent JetBlue, City Bakery, or Charity Water either. Crowdfunding is one thing, but the crowd isn't that good at inventing a breakthrough. There are 3 common confusions that many of us get stuck on. The first is that people confuse wants and needs. What we need is air, water, health, and a roof over our heads. Pretty much everything else is a want. And if we're privileged enough, we decide that those other things we want are actually needs. The second is that people are intimately aware of their wants, which they think of as needs, but they are absolutely terrible at inventing new ways to address those wants. They often prefer to use a familiar solution to satisfy their wants, even if it's not working very well. When it comes time to innovate, they get stuck. The third is mistakenly believing that everyone wants the same thing. In fact, we don't. The early adopters want things that are new. The laggards want things to never change. One part of the population wants chocolate, another vanilla. Innovative marketers invent new solutions that work with old emotions. While the 7 billion people on this planet are each unique, each a different collection of wants, needs, pain, and joy, in many ways, we're all the same. We share a basket of dreams and desires, all in different proportions, but with a ton of overlap. Here's a list, the foundational list, a shared vocabulary that each of us chooses from when expressing our dreams and fears. Adventure, affection, avoiding new things, belonging, community, control, creativity, delight, freedom of expression, freedom of movement, friendship, good looks, health, learning new things, luxury, nostalgia, obedience, participation, peace of mind, physical activity, power, reassurance, reliability, respect, revenge, romance, safety, security, sex, strength, sympathy, and tension. You could probably add 10 more, but it's unlikely you could add 50 more. This core basket of dreams and desires means that marketers, like artists, don't need many colors to paint an original masterpiece. And this is where we begin, with assertions. Assertions about what our audience, the folks we need to serve, want and need. Assertions about what's on their minds when they wake up, what they talk about when no one is eavesdropping, what they remember at the end of the day. And then we make assertions about how our story and our promise will interact with these wants and desires. When someone encounters us, will they see what we see? Will they want what we think they'll want? Will they take action? Don't begin with your machines, your inventory, or your tactics. Don't begin with what you know how to do or some sort of distraction about your mission. Instead, begin with dreams and fears, with emotional states, and with the change your customers seek. Nobody needs your product. It doesn't make sense to say people need a white leather wallet because, one, people don't need a wallet. They might want one, but that's different. Two, people might decide that they want a white leather wallet, but they don't want it because it's white or because it's leather. They want it because of how it will make them feel. That's what they're buying, a feeling, not a wallet. Identify that feeling before you spend time making a wallet. Marketers make change. We change people from one emotional state to another. We take people on a journey. We help them become the person they've dreamed of becoming, a little bit at a time. No one is happy to call a real estate broker. Not really. Despite what the broker is hoping, this isn't often a joyous interaction. They're afraid, nervous, relieved, eager to get going, anxious about moving, stressed about money, thinking about status gained or lost, concerned about the future, worried about their kids. The broker is a speed bump on the way to their future, and most of what he or she says is merely noise, a palliative, because it all costs the same anyway. According to statistics given to me by the National Association of Realtors, more than 80% of the people who hire a broker do so by choosing the first person to return their call. Given that, here's what I'd ask a broker seeking better. How will you choose to show up in the world? How will you reassure and soothe? Will you probe and explore? Will you claim that you're better, faster, more caring? Just as no one needs a drill bit, no one needs a real estate broker. what they need and want is how it makes them feel to get what a broker can get them. And the same thing is true for waiters, for limo drivers, and perhaps for you. Like real estate brokers, most of us do our most important work when we traffic in emotions, not commodities. Where's the angry bear? When someone doesn't act as you expected them to, look for their fear. It's difficult to dream of anything when you think you're about to be eaten by a grizzly, even, or especially, if it's all in your mind. What do you want? Let me guess. You'd like to be respected, successful, independent, appropriately busy, and maybe a little famous. You'd like to do work you're proud of and do it for people you care about. What's not on that list? That you need to own a certain color car. That you have to sell your items in packages that are 6 inches wide, not 7 inches. That you want all your customers to have first names with no fewer than 6 letters in them. The details don't matter so much. Just as your customers want to shift in their emotional states to move from fear to belonging, so do you. That leaves a huge amount of room, many degrees of freedom. It helps to follow certain truths of commerce. If you want to be independent, you probably need to own assets or a reputation. If you want to be financially well off, you probably need to deliver enough value to the right people that they will happily pay you for it. If you want to be proud of your work, you probably need to avoid racing to the bottom and denigrating the culture along the way. Within that framework, though, there's plenty of room. Room for you to dig in deep and decide what change you want to make and how and who you seek to serve. This might be a good time to go back to the edges exercise, to go through it again and find some new axes, new revelations, new promises. Find the people worth serving and then find a change worth making. Always be testing. It's tempting to make a boring product or service for everyone. Boring because boring is beyond criticism. It meets spec. It causes no tension. Everyone, because if everyone is happy, then no one is unhappy. The problem is that the marketplace of people who are happy with boring is static. They aren't looking for better. New and boring don't easily coexist. And so the people who are happy with boring aren't looking for you. They're actively avoiding you, in fact. The ever-faster cycles that require us to always be testing, to resist creating boredom, are driven by the fact that the only people we can serve are curious, dissatisfied, or bored. Everyone else can opt out and refuse to pay attention. The good news is that two extraordinary things have happened. Massive shifts in the way everything is sold to everyone. One, it's cheaper and faster than ever to create a prototype or a limited run. That's true for nonprofits, as well as for manufacturers or service businesses. Two, it's cheaper and faster than ever to find the early adopters, to engage with people who want to hear from you. This means it's on each of us to make an assertion. Outline a promise. Choose your extremes. Find the people you seek to change and show up with your offer. Call it a test if you want to, but it's real life. The real life of engaging with what's possible and of working with people who want to make a change. Always be seeking, connecting, solving, asserting, believing, seeing, and yes, testing. The other way to hear this is always be wrong. Well, not always. Sometimes you'll be right, but most of the time you'll be wrong. That's okay. Scrapbooking. Being wrong from scratch is exhausting. Radical originality doesn't have a high return on investment, and it will wear you out. Scrapbooking is an efficient alternative. When designing a website or an email campaign or a new product, you can scrapbook it. Find the things you think that those you engage with will be attracted to and will trust. The typefaces, the pricing, the offers, the images, the interfaces. And cut them up. Break them down into the original indivisible memes within. Then rebuild something new on top of these pieces. You can do the same thing when you put together your website, your podcast, or your new project. Find the essential beacons, the extremes, that matter to you and to your audience, and weave them together in a new thing. If you had to charge 10 times as much, what's the difference between a $30 massage and a $300 one? What could make a book worth $200 or a hotel room worth $1,500? What could cause someone to give $500 to charity instead of $50? More of the same is the wrong answer. In order to dramatically increase the size of your audience or the price that you charge, you'll need to do more than simply work more hours or interrupt more people. We don't pay 10 times extra for more words, a bigger order of French fries, or a louder stereo. Instead, it's a different extreme, a different story, a different sort of scarcity. Irresistible is rarely easy or rational. There's often a line out the door of Fiona's shop. It's not surprising. The ice cream is delicious. The portions are enormous. And a waffle cone costs less than $3 Canadian. And it's served with a smile, almost a grin. It's irresistible. Of course, once you finish the cone, you'll stroll around, hang out by the water, and maybe start to make plans about where to spend a week of next year's vacation. The Opinicon, a lovely little resort near Ottawa, could charge a lot more for an ice cream cone. A team of MBAs doing a market analysis and a profit and loss report would probably pin the value at about $8. That's where the return on investment would be at its peak. But they're not in the business of selling ice cream cones. The ice cream cones are a symbol, a beacon, a chance to engage. If you run everything through a spreadsheet, you might end up with a rational plan. But the rational plan isn't what creates energy or magic or memories. Stu Leonard's was a small supermarket with a big footprint. It was profiled by Tom Peters and had the highest sales per square foot of any store of its kind. Stu's was an experience, almost an amusement park, with remarkable customer service, clever merchandising, and interesting products to choose from. As the company grew to a few more stores, a new generation of owners took over who seemed more intent on short-term profit and less focused on magic. For a while, profits increased. But now, year after year, it's a bit less crowded, a bit less energetic, a bit less interesting. So, when a new store opens nearby, they lose a few more customers, then a few more, and finally, people begin to wonder, why do I even bother coming here in the first place? It might not be about being cheaper. It's tricky to define better. But without a doubt, the heart and soul of a thriving enterprise is the irrational pursuit of becoming irresistible. Chapter 8. More of the who. Seeking the smallest viable market. The virtuous cycle and network effects. Every very good customer gets you another one. Dead-end customers aren't worth the trouble. Silent customers, jealous customers, people who think you need to be kept a secret. You can't grow your work on a cul-de-sac. Your best customers become your new salespeople. Your work to change the culture thrives when the word spreads. And if you want the word to spread, you need to build something that works better when it gets spread. That creates the positive cycle you're seeking, the one that makes change happen. The most effective remarkability comes from design. The fax machine was remarkable. It spread not because of a clever ad campaign, but because users chose to talk about it. Why? Because the fax machine works better if your colleagues have one too. Bob Metcalf saw this firsthand when he invented Ethernet. 3Com's original offering permitted 3 users to hook up their PCs and share a printer. That's a marginal benefit, not much to talk about. But once users began to share data, everything changed. Now, you were in one of 2 states, in the network or off the network. And if you were isolated, off the network, that was painful. The more people joined the network, the more people talked about the network. That made isolation even more painful. The original slide behind Metcalfe's law had just 2 lines on it. You can see an example of it at seths.blog/charts. The straight line shows that the cost of adding each person to the network goes up slowly. The curved line, though, shows that the value of adding 1 more person to the network is exponentially greater. This simple network effect is at the heart of every mass movement and every successful culture change. It happens when remarkable is designed right into the story of your change. And more important, when the product or service works better when I use it with others. The conversation I'm motivated to have with my peers becomes the engine of growth. Growth creates more value, which leads to more growth. And then a miracle happens. Here's the truth about customer traction. A miracle isn't going to happen. The old school marketer's dream revolves around transforming a product, this normal, average, it's fine product or service, the one that's sitting there with nothing much happening, transform it into a hit. The dream is that with public relations, with hype, with promotion, with distribution, with ad buys, with influence marketing, with content marketing, and with a little bit of spam, the dream is that it will become the it thing, and everyone will want it. It will be popular precisely because it's popular. But you're not fooled by this. Sure, every so often a superstar is born, but most of the time, this approach merely leads to failure, expensive failure. The alternative is to seek a path, not a miracle. And that path begins with customer traction. Here's what I want to know about your VC-backed Silicon Valley startup. How many people outside of HQ use it every day? How often are they sending you suggestions to make it better? Here's what else I want to know. How many people are insisting that their friends and colleagues use it, as in right now? Do they love it? Do they love themselves more because they love you? That restaurant you just opened, how many people come back night after night to eat there, bringing new friends each time? Or that booth at the farmer's market, or the nonprofit you're starting, or your local babysitting service. Who would miss it if it were gone? If you can't succeed in the small, why do you believe you will succeed in the large? 1,000 true fans. In 2008, Kevin Kelly, founding editor of Wired, wrote an essay that described the simple truth of the smallest viable market. For the independent creator of intellectual property, a singer, perhaps, or a writer, It turns out that 1,000 true fans might be sufficient to live a better than decent life. To quote Kevin, a true fan is defined as a fan that will buy anything you produce. These diehard fans will drive 200 miles to see you sing. They will buy the hardback and paperback and audible versions of your book. They will purchase your next figurine, sight unseen. They will pay for the best of DVD version of your free YouTube channel. They will come to your chef's table once a month. If you have roughly 1,000 true fans like this, also known as superfans, you can make a living if you are content to make a living, but not a fortune. That's 1,000 people who will support you on Patreon, or 1,000 people who will buy your new project on Kickstarter the day you launch it. It's 1,000 people who not only care about your work, but also spread the word to those around them. The challenge for most people who seek to make an impact isn't winning over the mass market. It's the micro market. They bend themselves into a pretzel trying to please the anonymous masses before they have 50 or 100 people who would miss them if they were gone. While it might be comforting to dream of becoming a Kardashian, it's way more productive to matter to a few instead. But what about Hamilton? The hit that proves the theory. The hit that represents not only the triumph of one creator over the status quo, but the magical narrative of a singular piece of effort and art that changes everything. Except, for more than a year, Hamilton was seen by only a few hundred people a night. Except that even when it's running at full capacity in New York, breaking records on Broadway, it's only being seen by a few thousand people. Except that even as it's changing a small part of the culture in cities like Chicago, it's been seen by less than 1% of the U.S. population. Its best-selling soundtrack album only sold a few hundred thousand copies. And the companion book, a surprise bestseller, sold about that many as well. Our hits aren't hits anymore. Not like they used to be. Instead, they are meaningful for a few and invisible to the rest. What would Jerry do? I often tell the story of the Grateful Dead, and yet almost no one has the guts to commit to this sort of service, the leadership of connection. I first wrote about them 10 years ago, and yet too many of us fall into the trap of seeking whatever passes for the top 40 in our industry instead. So far, I've purchased 233 different Grateful Dead albums, more than 500 hours of music altogether. The Dead are an almost perfect example of the power of marketing for the smallest viable market. It's worth a few minutes to deconstruct what they did and how they did it, because it will inform the long, strange trip we're on here. Although it's become a familiar example, musicians, publishers, gym owners, consultants, chefs, and teachers seem to forget the core lesson in the Dead's failure to race for a hit. First, few kids grow up wanting to start a band like the Grateful Dead. The Dead had a grand total of one top 40 Billboard hit. One. They're easily dismissed as some sort of quirky hippie band. They have fans, true fans. Fans who are easily dismissed as quirky hippies. And yet the Dead grossed more than $350 million in revenue while Jerry Garcia was alive, and another $100 million since his death. I'm not even counting record sales, just concert tickets. Most of that run was accomplished when ticket prices averaged just $23. How? Because the true fans showed up. Because the true fans spread the word. And because the true fans never fully satisfied their need to be connected. Here are the key elements of the Dead's marketing success. They appealed to a relatively tiny audience and focused all their energy on them. They didn't use radio to spread their ideas to the masses. Instead, they relied on fans to share the word, hand to hand, by encouraging them to tape their shows. Instead of hoping to encourage a large number of people to support them a little, they relied on a small number of true fans who supported them a lot. They picked the extremes on the XY axis, live concerts versus polished records, long jams for the fan family versus short hits for the radio, and owned them both. They gave the fans plenty to talk about and stand for, insiders and outsiders. They needed three things to pull this off. Extraordinary talent. You can't fake your way through 146 concerts in a year. Significant patience. In 1972, considered by some to be a peak year for the band, only 5,000 people came to a typical show. It took more than a decade before The Dead became an overnight success. The guts to be quirky. It couldn't have been easy to watch the Zombies, the Doors, and even the Turtles sell far more records than they did. For a while, anyway. In 1972, being obstinate, generous, and lucky was an accident that led to their surprising success. Today, though, in most industries, including the music business, this sort of success is not an accident. It's the best path to success, and in many ways, the most rewarding as well. Taylor Swift is not your role model. Consider Scott Borchetta, who runs Big Machine Records. He's had more than 200 number one singles. That's an awe-inspiring total. A world-class marketer. He's sold more than 30 million records for Taylor Swift, and Swift's tour revenue is about the same as The Dead's was. Taylor and Scott are hit machines. Most markets need someone to be a hit machine, and for the music business right now, it's them. As we'll see, every long tail has a short head, a place where the hits live. Hits serve a useful purpose to our culture, but the essential lesson is this. Someone is going to make hits, and it's probably not going to be you. If you can find a playbook on how to become a hit machine, to become the one who regularly creates the mass movement that changes the middle of the market, go for it. For the rest of us, there's the other path, the path of connection, empathy, and change. All critics are right. All critics are wrong. The critic who doesn't like your work is correct. He doesn't like your work. This cannot be argued with. The critic who says that no one else will like your work is wrong. After all, you like your work. Someone else might like it too. This is the only way to understand the 1-star and 5-star reviews that every best-selling book on Amazon receives. How could one book possibly get both? Either it's good or it's not. Not true. 12% of the 21,000 reviews for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone gave it 1 or 2 stars. To visualize that, out of 100 readers, 12 said it was one of the worst books they'd ever read. What this bimodal distribution teaches us is that there are at least 2 audiences that interact with every best-selling book. There's the desired audience, the one that has a set of dreams and beliefs and wants that perfectly integrates with this work. And there's the accidental audience, the one that gets more satisfaction out of not liking the work, out of hating it, and sharing that thought with others. They're both right, but neither is particularly useful. When we seek feedback, we're doing something brave and foolish. We're asking to be proven wrong, to have people say, You thought you made something great, but you didn't. Ouch. What if instead we seek advice? Seek it like this. I made something that I like, that I thought you'd like. How'd I do? What advice do you have for how I could make it fit your worldview more closely? That's not criticism or feedback. That sort of helpful advice reveals a lot about the person you're engaging with. It helps us see his or her fears and dreams and wants. It's a clue on how to get even closer next time. Plenty of people can tell you how your work makes them feel. We're intimately familiar with the noise in our own heads, and that noise is often expressed as personal or specific criticism. But it might not be about you, and it might not be useful. Perhaps you're hearing about someone's fears or their narrative about inadequacy or unfairness. When people share their negative stories, they often try to broaden the response and universalize it. They talk about how no one or everyone will feel. But what you're actually hearing about is a specific sore spot that was touched in a specific moment by a specific piece of work. This is the person who posts a one-star review because the book arrived late for the baby shower, or the customer who's angry because she spent more than she budgeted for on her wedding. That's quite different from someone giving you useful advice about how to work with someone like them in the future. It's worth the effort to insulate ourselves from a raw emotional onslaught and to tease out substantial, useful direction instead. Why don't people choose you? Here's another difficult exercise, one that stretches the empathy muscle of a typical marketer. Those people who don't buy from you, the ones who don't take your calls, who sneer at your innovations, who happily buy from a competitor, even if they know you exist. Those people. Why are they right? Why are people who don't choose you correct in their decision to not choose you? If you've worked hard, it's tempting to denigrate their judgment, to question their values, and assume that these folks are either ill-informed, selfish, or simply wrong-headed. Put that aside for a moment and find the empathy to fill in this sentence. For people who want what you want and believe what you believe, your choice of is exactly correct. Because it is. People are quite likely to make perfectly rational decisions based on what they see, what they believe, and what they want. If you're a career coach, then explain why people who don't hire a coach have made a smart decision. Or explain why people who are using someone else to coach them have done something that makes sense for them. Years ago, I went to a cooking class that a friend had bought me as a gift. The chef was teaching everyone to make a dish that used ground veal. Any questions? He asked. One student had the temerity to raise his hand and ask, "Is it okay to make this dish with ground turkey instead?" In a thick accent, the chef sneered, "You could, if you wanted it to taste like dirt." Of course, they were both right. For the student, the availability, health benefits, or moral imperatives associated with choosing turkey over veal might mean that he cared more about the story than he did about matching the taste profile that was on offer. For the teacher, for whom the Proustian memory of this dish was everything, the idea of substitutions disrespected the effort he was putting into his work. That's what right means in this case. Based on who they are and what they want and what they know, everyone is right, every time. When we find the empathy to say, "I'm sorry, this isn't for you. Here's the phone number of my competitor," then we also find the freedom to do work that matters. Chapter 9. People like us do things like this. Deep change is difficult and worth it. As we've seen, every organization, every project, every interaction exists to do one thing, to make change happen, to make a sale, to change a policy, to heal the world. As marketers and agents of change, we almost always overrate our ability to make change happen. The reason is simple. Everyone always acts in accordance with their internal narratives. You can't get someone to do something they don't want to do. And most of the time, what people want to do is to take action or not take action that reinforces their internal narratives. The real question, then, is where does the internal narrative come from? And how does it get changed? Or, more likely, how do we use the internal narrative to change the actions that people take? Some people have an internal narrative that makes them open to changing their behavior. For example, Quincy Jones likes many kinds of music, while others begin the process with great resistance. For most of us, though, changing our behavior is driven by our desire to fit in. People like us do things like this, and our perception of our status, affiliation, and dominance. Since both these forces often push us to stay as we are, it takes tension to change them. Once you see these forces at work, you'll be able to navigate the culture in a whole new way. It will be as if someone turned on the lights and gave you a map. People like us do things like this. Have you eaten crickets? Never mind the crunchy, insect-shaped kind, but even cricket flour? In many parts of the world, crickets are a fine source of protein. What about beef? Even though this is one of the most easily addressed causes of global warming, even though beef is a truly inefficient way to feed the world, it's safe to say that most people listening to this have had beef for lunch or dinner sometime in the last week. If it's not genetic, if we're not born with a predetermined feeling about crickets versus beef, if there are no clear-cut rational reasons to eat one or the other, why do crickets make us squirm while cows make us hungry, or vice versa? Because people like us eat things like this. For most of us, from the first day we are able to remember until the last day we breathe, our actions are primarily driven by one question. Do people like me do things like this? People like me don't cheat on their taxes. People like me own a car. We don't take the bus. People like me have a full-time job. People like me want to see the new James Bond movie. Even when we adopt the behavior of an outlier, when we do something the crowd doesn't often do, we're still aligning ourselves with the behavior of outliers. Nobody is unaware and uncaring of what is going on around him. No one is wholly original, self-directed, and isolated in every way. A sociopath might do things in opposition to the crowd, but he's not unaware of the crowd. We can't change the culture, but each of us has the opportunity to change a culture, our little pocket of the world. The smallest viable market makes sense because it maximizes your chances of changing a culture. The core of your market, enriched and connected by the change you seek to make, organically shares the word with the next layer of the market, and so on. This is people like us. Case study: The Blue Ribbons. My little town had a problem. Despite having extraordinary schools, our elementary school had won the National Blue Ribbon School designation. There was a schism over the upcoming budget vote. Many in town, particularly long-time residents,